This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. The third wave is hitting us hard, and it's different, more contagious, and more dangerous for younger people. The focus for vaccination has shifted to the so-called hot zones, where the most outbreaks are occurring, and there are calls to shift much of the province's supplies there. And while the focus now seems to be younger people, especially the very tragic death of a 13-year-old girl, the fact is that most of the people who are in hospital, in ICUs, or dying are over 60. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'm joined by Dr. Alon Vaisman, infectious diseases and infection control physician at the University Health Network. Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, thanks for coming on. I'll tell you what's kind of at the top of my mind now, and I've heard a lot of other people asking the same question. So, you know, we were expecting to have a lot of supplies of AstraZeneca. We don't because of the terrible situation in India. And a lot of people are wondering if you can mix vaccines, if you can get a second dose of a different vaccine than you had your first dose. And are you aware of any studies on that, or what is the situation?
The current recommendation from the CDC and other health bodies is that we don't mix and match vaccines. We don't know whether that's effective. So the first dose that you received, the vaccine that you received, your first dose should be the same that you received your second. And even just thinking from a practical point of view, it's unlikely that the producers of each of these vaccines are going to want to enroll patients in a study that includes essentially a rival or competitor's vaccine. So, I mean, we really don't know the answer to that. Presumably, if it's two mRNA vaccines, it's probably not a big deal, but nobody's advising that to be done. We do advise that people use the same vaccine that they got their first dose with.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting because I was talking to Dr. Peter Uni a week ago, and he was musing about this maybe happening in the future. I'm not sure if he was referring to booster shots as opposed to the second shot.
Yeah, with any kind of vaccine that we have so far, we always recommend the same type of vaccine be given the second time. It certainly is possible that in the future, if you have to require a third dose or a booster shot in a year's time, there's no reason to believe why you couldn't start a new series. So when you start a series, you should finish it. But if you need a second series of vaccines, there's no reason to believe why you couldn't get something else entirely. We know that from flu vaccinations, people do receive over the years various types of vaccines annually. And so that's certainly acceptable. And that's based on what we know of which vaccines work best in which populations.
Now, the military is arriving here. What do you make of that?
I think any kind of help we can get, it makes sense, especially in areas of the country, or areas of the province, I should say, that are most hard hit. So we know that the northwest area of Toronto and area in Peel as well, where there is very high numbers of hospitalizations, ICU admissions, that's where the most help can be provided. And, you know, whereas in the first and second wave, there was concern about help being provided to the long-term care facilities. Now the more overwhelmed areas are the acute care facilities, are the hospitals, particularly the general wards, and especially the ICU admissions. We're still seeing, you know, almost 60 new admissions to the ICU every day.
Wow. I want to ask you, because we've seen this move on the part of the long-term care ministry, and they want to move people who are alternate level of care into nursing homes. And it seems to me that's what caused a big problem the last time. And they also want to allow PSWs and other workers who are vaccinated to work in multiple homes. Does that give you any pause?
I think one of the big differences this time is that there's vaccination available. So whereas placing patients in long-term care facilities would have been a high-risk maneuver in wave one or wave two, there is a significant number of people vaccinated in those areas, patients and health staff, making it you know, perhaps the more safe place for people to be at this point. The other thing to recognize is that, you know, you can think of the situation as being like a green zone, a yellow zone, red zone kind of situation with your workforce, with your manpower. If you're in a, you know, a light situation, then yeah, you would try to restrict things and do things a little bit more carefully. But when you're in a red zone situation where manpower is at there's a shortage and you need, and your priority is patient safety, then you will have to do a few things that you wouldn't otherwise do, because ultimately the most important thing is to keep patients safe.
Well, that's the thing. Vaccine hesitancy among workers in long-term care has been pegged as high as 30%. And, you know, my understanding is that they don't even have to tell you.
Right. So there is, it's important for the public to recognize that whether or not an individual is immunized is actually private health information. So technically, at this point in Ontario, you're not required to provide that information to your employer. If you're asked, you certainly can volunteer that information. And at every hospital, the occupational health departments are always asking staff to volunteer that information, so that's known. But you're right, it's not required for you to volunteer that at this point. Although it is required for you to provide other personal health information to occupational health, just not this.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I would imagine it's a pretty tricky situation. From what I know now, and we have to check it, it's voluntary. Do you know of patients in your own facilities, ALC patients, who have volunteered to move into nursing homes?
Yes, that's certainly part of the approach. I think it's also important to recognize that people who are deemed ALC have a variety of care needs. Some may have very high requirements and require a lot of 24-hour care, for example, where they must, you know, be most appropriately looked after in some of these long-term care facilities, whereas others are requiring some other level of care. So I think it all depends on those specific patients and where they're best suited. But certainly having those patients admitted to a hospital ward, an acute care ward, for long periods of time, it doesn't benefit them, and it doesn't benefit the people around them, the patients who are acutely ill. So having those patients placed in another environment, it actually benefits them as well.
Right. But of course, this has been a really hugely longstanding problem, a problem from long before the pandemic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This has been always a long-term problem, is having patients who do not require an acute care bed, having them there and finding the most safe and appropriate place for them to be outside of a hospital.
Okay, I'm going to take a call from Joe in Toronto. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, it's really alarming and actually quite unimaginable, you know, what's happening in this province where we're moving so many people away from 416 hospitals, and we're relocating these people as far away as North Bay and Hamilton and Kingston. Like, what is going on? Like, seriously, I know it's just poor planning on the part of the government and the ministry.
I don't know, but if it's poor planning or you know, their fault.
Well, it's not good planning, Libby. I don't think it's good planning, because this is something unprecedented and never seen in this province, where, you know, we're moving loved ones into completely different jurisdictions. And this is just a ministry that's scrambling because, you know, they're so ill-prepared. And I don't see how that's how anybody could have planned that. That there's no way that people have actually planned that. Am I often saying that?
It's just, we have ICUs. They're full. They're full because of the pandemic. Anyway, thanks for your call, Joe. We get your drift. Alon at University Health Network, have they been transferring patients elsewhere?
Yes, it all depends on your individual hospital, but certainly in our hospital, there was a point where we did need to transfer people out. And that ebbs and flows depending on the capacity. And certainly we do also accept patients who need higher levels of care. As you may know, also the care called ECMO, where it's heart and lung bypassed in order to help certain patients who are very sick. So absolutely, what we're seeing now is a very unfortunate situation where the ICU capacity has been pushed to its limits. We're using non-conventional spaces now for patients requiring intensive care, even what we call surge spaces in areas we don't usually have patients. And this is occurring in numerous hospitals across Toronto to look after these patients.
Yeah, like the hallway.
Not exactly the hallway, but some other spaces that are less than ideal at some points in some areas.
So do you think that there seems to have been a shift in this third wave, that the province and other authorities keep lowering the age and trying to shift supply and do these pop-up clinics in these hard-hit zones? In your opinion, is that the right response?
Yeah, the only way to get out of a pandemic, of this kind of pandemic, is vaccination. That's really it. Lockdowns are just temporizing measures. They do their job for a short period of time, but you know you can't sustain them forever. So vaccination is the only way to permanently get you out of the situation, and we know that to be true based on the experience of other countries, even the United States in many areas. So the faster you can get them out, the more you can attack the virus in places where it's most common, the faster you can get out of the pandemic.
Right, but we still have, under this regime still, unless we hear otherwise, we are stretching the interval between the doses longer than the recommended interval.
That's right, and that's purely just a function of vaccine supply, that if the supply in Canada was better, we wouldn't need to space out the intervals. But we do have more and more data saying that even one dose is highly effective. Last week, a paper from Israel in the New England Journal of Medicine showed exactly that there is a high degree of protection, even with one dose of the vaccine. And so the philosophy being it's better for me to have 80% and you to have 80% protection rather than me have 100 and you have zero. That's the reality we're dealing with now.
Okay, I'm going to take one quick call before we let you go, Alon. We've got Robert in Etobicoke. Hi, Robert.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I had the COVID once already. And my physician said I wouldn't get it again. And for some reason, I don't believe him. I already had my vax.
Dr. Vaisman?
Yes, that's an excellent question. It's about timing of the vaccine after you've had COVID. Certainly, it's recommended that everyone get vaccinated, even if you've had COVID before. We're just not certain about what the appropriate timing is after you've had COVID. Somewhere in a range of a month, 2 months, or 3 months is about right. It's not to do with safety. It certainly is safe. Just about when can you get the optimal response after you get COVID. So certainly a month, 2 months, 3 months after you've had COVID, you should absolutely get vaccinated.
Robert, no, I had the COVID last October.
Okay, Robert is asking if he can get it again.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So COVID reinfection is quite rare, but it certainly does happen. And so we think that it happens somewhere in the range of three to 6 months. So it certainly can happen, but it's infrequent.
Okay. Dr. Vaisman, thank you so much for being with us. As always, we really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. We are going to take another break. And when we come back, there is in the works a pilot project that would allow pharmacies to dispense the Pfizer vaccine, and the reason for that is that is the most reliable supply, apparently, and we will be talking about that when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to 1. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. This week, we learned that a select number of pharmacies will be participating in a pilot project to administer the Pfizer vaccine. Up until now, pharmacies were only injecting people with AstraZeneca, but that supply is drying up given the horrible situation in India, which has stopped exports of the vaccine while their crisis rages. So federal officials say the supply from Pfizer is the most reliable, and that's why they're testing its use in drugstores despite some logistical challenges. So if you have questions about this, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. Let's go to Justin Bates. He's the CEO of the Ontario Pharmacists Association. Hey, Justin.
Hey, great to be back on your program.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us. So do you have any more details about when, how many pharmacies will be participating in this?
We continue to work on the final details with the Ministry of Health. Our expectation would be later this week, hopefully within the next couple of days, we'll be launching in a limited fashion in 8 pharmacies in Toronto, as well as 8 in Peel region. So there'll be 16 in total. Those locations are essentially chosen by the public health units and the Ministry of Health to be in hotspots. And there will be a limited amount of Pfizer supply. Our hope is about 2 weeks we'll be able to test out all the operational elements and then broaden it out to other hotspot regions.
Mm-hmm. So it's all in hotspots. I'm glad to see that there are an equal number in Peel, because that's been a big concern that they didn't get their fair share, what they saw as their fair share of vaccine supply and pharmacies who were administering it. So 8 pharmacies, do they know who they are yet?
We're just working out the final pieces. They are selected and they are aware of it. It'll be made public within the next 24 hours, likely.
Okay. And how quickly after that will people be able to get their shot?
Well, we're anticipating later this week. So if we can launch Wednesday, Thursday timeframe, then it'll be opened up in terms of bookings, and the details will be provided.
Okay, so it's going to be bookings, no sort of first come, first serve thing.
Well, I think with Pfizer in particular, it's important to manage this very carefully, because the expiration date on this is a lot quicker than it is for the AstraZeneca vaccine. So these are thawed once they arrive to the pharmacy, and they're good for 5 days. And that's storing it in a fridge temperature, as opposed to the 30 days that you have as a window with the other vaccines. So in that respect, we want to make sure that we line up the appointments to the inventory that we have so that there's no wastage.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are some of the logistical challenges we're hearing? You know, at the beginning of the rollout, there was this whole, there was a lot of reservations because of the temperature it had to be kept at, and it was the explanation or the excuse for not rolling it out in the way it was originally intended. So what logistical challenges do you expect?
Well, we do benefit from seeing the other provinces that have moved to enable pharmacies to administer Pfizer as well as the U.S., so we've incorporated some of those lessons learned. The most complex part of this is in its distribution. It's not as stable as the AstraZeneca or Moderna vaccine, so it can't be moved around a lot, and it has to be kept at ultra-frozen temperatures while it's being stored until it's thawed, and then you only have that 5-day period. It's also more complex to draw it out of the vial. There's the dilution that goes with it. There's 6 doses that are in the vial compared to 10 with AstraZeneca and Moderna. So some differences there in terms of the actual application and administering it. But all of these things are available as resources to pharmacists. They've been educated and trained to do this. Some pharmacists are already doing this as they volunteer in public health units and the clinics. So we're well prepared to launch this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I'm thinking if CVS in the States can do it, there's no reason that our people can't do it.
Yeah, and the experience in Alberta has been a good one, Nova Scotia as well. And we know that it can be done. It's just a matter of more just-in-time delivery, managing the inventory, matching it to the appointments, and moving the product a lot faster than we have with the other vaccines.
Mm-hmm. And I read somewhere, don't remember where, that Pfizer is working on making their vaccine a little easier to deal with.
Well, that would certainly be welcome. The less complex, the easier it will be to distribute it within the community. I think, you know, given the supply challenges that we've seen with Moderna being unpredictable, AstraZeneca will probably be out in most pharmacies, if not tomorrow, by the end of the week, with no known schedule for replenishment from the U.S. or elsewhere. So as you said on the outset, Pfizer is the most predictable and certain of the supply and will be certainly more available. So anything that can make it more accessible in the community is a good thing.
What about AstraZeneca? What about all those people, and I have to say myself included, that got a dose of AstraZeneca? Do you have any kind of information for us about that second dose?
Yes, and I'm in that cohort as well. I just received my AstraZeneca yesterday, and it's an important part of the planning is that we need to make sure that we have enough AstraZeneca doses to apply the second dose within that 16-week time frame. So we're encouraged by the discussions the federal government's having with President Biden in the U.S. We know they have 60 million doses sitting in a warehouse that will expire soon, and they have committed to distributing that beyond the borders of the U.S. They're not going to use any of it, which is hard to believe in the U.S. because they have much more of Pfizer and Moderna. So I'm optimistic that we will have enough to cover off all of the second doses that have been administered.
But given the crisis in India, and the Joe Biden has made a commitment to send certainly most, if not all of that stuff to India, where they're frankly in a lot worse shape than we are.
Yeah, there's no doubt a significant amount of it will go there. And there's other priorities as well. But I do think we'll get some of that or look at other sources as well.
Now, I also read, and I don't know if our government is aware, but I also read that Israel has a bunch of AstraZeneca that they don't need. Is anyone aware of that?
Well, I know the federal government's working on that. The current mix we have is actually from Sweden and from the U.S. of AstraZeneca that's out in the community. So it wouldn't be, certainly unprecedented to mix from different countries. And I think that's part of the whole COVAX system worldwide was meant to be sharing and prioritizing and sending vaccines so that we can replenish and not have supply interruptions.
I thought that our supply was from the Serum Institute in India.
Well, that was the first one. We did receive the Covishield, which came from India, and we ran through that in the first phase where we had 165,000 doses in the 327 stores in three regions. But we received a second shipment from the U.S. and some from Sweden that allowed us to supply the stores in phase two and three. That got us to 1,400 now.
So you're saying that as early as tomorrow, we may get the details on the pilot project. Just to recap, 8 pharmacies here in Toronto, 8 in Peel region, and how many doses?
We're still working out how many doses, but it will likely be in the neighborhood of about 50 per pharmacy. That's to be determined, but there's a limited amount that have been reallocated, and until next month when new shipments come in and the allocations will be done with the public health units and pharmacies, we won't know exactly when we broaden it how many will be available, but that's stuff that we're working on right now.
And what will the criteria be for getting it in the pharmacy, the age cutoff or anything like that?
That's a detail that we'll be able to share likely tomorrow, but I'm optimistic that it will be 18 plus and it'll allow us to address some of the gaps, especially in the hotspot regions for essential workers that are at risk and educators and others that we know need to get vaccinated in order to get the pandemic under control.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you'd like to leave us with?
We're ready for this. This is something we've been advocating for since the launch of the program, having all vaccines accessible through community pharmacies and other means is the only way we're going to accelerate the vaccinations across the province. So I think pharmacists have demonstrated our ability to mobilize quickly and do it safely, and we're ready for this next challenge.
Okay. Justin Bates, thank you so much.
Appreciate the time. Thank you.
Okay. So there you go, people. We will get more details tomorrow, but hopefully by the end of the week, if you're in a hotspot, you'll be able to get a Pfizer vaccine in a pharmacy courtesy of a pilot project. And that's all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Tuesday, time for our crack strategy panel. And top of mind is the province's handling of the terrible third wave of COVID. Now, there's been a cascade of demands from medical and civic leaders to expand paid sick days as a key to stopping the spread of the virus. And last week, the premier promised, quote, the best program in North America. And as you heard in Bob's news this morning, the province confirmed it wants to double the current federal sick benefit for workers to $1,000 a week. But here is the head scratcher. Its condition is that Ottawa is to administer the program. And from everything that we have heard, the umpteen hours that this has been debated, the problem is that Ottawa administers the program, that it takes a long time to receive the money. You have to apply for it. And that just doesn't work for low-wage workers who need cash to put food on the table and pay the rent. And that's why they are reluctant to stay home when they feel sick. So let's begin there. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740. Toll free, 1-866-740-4740. And now I'd like to welcome Karen Stintz, CEO of Variety Village, John Capobianco, Senior Vice President and Senior Partner, Fleischman Hillard High Road, and Charles Souza, the former Minister of Finance for Ontario and Member of Provincial Parliament for Mississauga South. Hi, everyone.
Hi, Libby.
Hello.
Hey, good afternoon, all.
Okay, let us begin with Charles. I would imagine that you may have seen some of this provincial, federal back and forth in your day. How does this make sense, asking the federal government to administer it when the fact that it takes so long to get money is a big holdup?
Yeah, this is pretty classic, right? Here we have a provincial government that obviously needs some support. They're under a lot of pressure with regards to paid sick days because it's been ongoing for so long, and we had it instituted, which they then did away with when they came to power, and now it's come to basically bite them in the butt. And now they're trying to do what they can. You know, he says he wants to do it bigger and better. It's a bit of an overpromise that he made again in regards to this issue, and he's putting the onus on the federal government. The federal government, to their credit, have been providing a lot of support to Ontario through these through their program EBSERVE. They already have a federally regulated sick days policy for their federal regulated businesses, and they're saying to the province, "You do the same." In that case, then we'll talk. And I spoke to Michael Couteau yesterday, who brought forward the private members' bill around sick days, and he was pleased that the NDP spoke in favor of it, but not surprised that the PCs, once again, are saying, we don't want to put the onus on employers. We're going to put it on the taxpayers. If we go to the federal government, let the rest of Canada help pay for it. And that's, in essence, what they're doing.
Well, no, they said that they will cover the extra $500 a week.
Fair enough.
But
to do more, right?
Pardon?
They're asking the federal government to administer it and to put up more money.
Right. But that's the crux of the issue, that these people can't wait.
They can, and again, they're putting something forward under their jurisdiction, under their purview, and they're deflecting it by putting the onus and the responsibility on the federal government yet again. And they're not taking ownership, and they're not showing leadership to do so right now when it's most needed.
John, what's your response to that?
Well, I would say that, and Charles knows this as the former federal minister in Ontario, that there's always reliant on the federal government for money. They've got the money. They've got the ability to make it. They've got the ability to spend it more than the provinces. And more importantly, their responsibility is to distribute it to the provinces. And I think the problem has always been this, and that is at the very beginning of the pandemic, at the height of the crisis, you know, you saw a lot of cooperation between the provinces and the feds, and even, quite frankly, the municipal governments. But as this pandemic has moved on, has moved forward, and it's gotten, in some cases, more complicated, worse, we're seeing new variants, we're seeing all of this mix up with vaccines and all this kind of stuff, you're seeing a bit of a splinter between the cooperation of all three levels of government, because, you know, one level of government tries to do what they can, the federal government, to sort of make sure that there's some level of standard or some level of equity across the country when it comes to vaccines, when it comes to payments, and all of the issues that they've been able to deal with. But the provinces, who have to rely on the federal government for a lot of these things, get sort of stymied by it, and in some cases have to say and have to point to the federal government. Ford, the premier, has always said when it comes to sick pay, that the federal government has a program. There's multi-million dollars of money that was earmarked for that. They had the Canadian Recovery Benefit Plan that allowed for some of that. But the issue was and continues to be that it was never enough. Critics were always saying that. Even the premier was saying that. So I think the fact that he stepped up and said, look, we're going to double it to $1,000 in 4 weeks is good. But you can't do it alone. You have to have the federal government helping. And I think that's been the challenge. And that is the federal government makes these announcements when they do. But then when it comes to the rubber hitting the road,
and actually where the action happens, it fails on a number of cases. Vaccines, we've seen it. We've seen it on some programs. I think the provincial government was looking forward to this federal budget to add more money to that particular item, and it didn't happen. So the premier had to step up and do it himself.
Right. But again, the issue has always been that these workers cannot afford an interruption in the money they receive, Karen. And yes, having the federal government administer it, it is not going to solve that problem.
No. So there's a couple issues that have been talked about. You know, one is that the workers need the money right away. The second is that the federal government has a program that actually doesn't administer very well, compounded with the calls for the provincial government to develop a program they actually don't have. And so I'm sympathetic actually to the Ford government, because for them to now figure out how they are going to develop, administer a more effective sick day program than the federal government hasn't yet figured out is actually a big ask. And it's not letting them off the hook by any stretch of the imagination, but to think that this government can turn around a sick day policy and program and implementation and actually have it deliver cash to workers who need it in time is probably not reasonable. So I think that the idea that they would go to the federal government and say, can you deliver this on our behalf and we'll flip the bill, is a reasonable one. But then to have the federal government come back and say, well, you need to mandate employers to pay sick days, it doesn't help us. And so the question is, as an employer, my staff have to take time off to go get tested, and I've paid for it as an employer because it's in my interest to have healthy employees. I also have the benefit of collecting the Canadian Emergency Wage benefit for my employees, so it doesn't cost me as much money. So I think it is right for the federal government to say, employers, you are responsible for the health and safety of your employees. If they are sick and spreading this pandemic, then that's on you to fix. And if you need to collect some emergency wage subsidy, collect it, because if an interrupted paycheck is the most effective way to keep these workers from feeling that they can't feed their family. So the benefit should flow from the federal government to the employer, to the worker, and then the federal government and provincial government can do the accounting at a later date.
I know that what a lot of people were talking about is that if, you know, they don't want employers to bear the added cost, there'd be some kind of rebate program. But the only way to make this work is uninterrupted wages for people, Charles.
There's no question. And the only way to do that, Libby, is have the employer pay the worker with a commitment that the provincial and federal government will work it out on their behalf. And, you know, quite frankly, and again, you know, we talk about the divide, right? Where I'm divided because my business is closed. And so in order for me to reopen, I need this pandemic to get under control. So I need the workplaces that are open to do something to help with that effort. And so if it takes tax dollars to figure out how to get those employees what they need safely, whether it's testing, whether it's isolation, whether it's quarantine, it's in my interest as a business owner, as an individual, as a citizen, to help make that happen. But the employer has an obligation as well.
Charles.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that this has taken so long. I mean, this discussion has been ongoing for almost a year. And, you know, to John's point, it's unreasonable now to expect something to happen quickly at the last minute on both sides of government, on both levels. So I'm with Karen on this. Let's ensure that people get paid and let them work it out, the repayment with the respective governments. And the feds in this case are just a transfer agent. Now, to expect them to administer this for Ontario, they'd have to do something similar for the rest of Canada. And that's a big ask, too. So I think the province has a duty. There's a responsibility in them to put something forward. And if they're prepared to put up a half of it, then put it up. Just go ahead and put something, institute something for the benefit of those employers so that they at least know, at least the provincial government is on board. It's unfortunate because there's a politicization of this issue. It has been ongoing as well. So I do sympathize with the Ford government, and I also recognize that there's some politics here, but the ideologies that are so different is creating a real dilemma for people's lives. And I look at some of the politicizations of that young girl, Emily Viega, who passed away in Brampton. Her parents are essential workers who are unable to stay home because they can't afford to, and they're going to work sick or they're coming back sick. And these are the sorts of things that are happening. And then MPPs are defending it by blaming others for international travel and so forth. And it saddens me because these sort of things should have been resolved a long time ago.
Yeah, Charles, I know that you bring up that the Liberal government had two paid sick days, but two paid sick days wouldn't go very far to covering an isolation.
But imagine having something already in place that doesn't exist, and then you can build upon it afterwards. You know, we would have had a system in place that would enable us to at least expand it there afterwards, or allow the provincial government and the federal government to top it up there in that case. But what has happened is they removed it completely.
John, is it ideology that is preventing the Ford government from doing something like that? That's what all along people have suggested. The employers keep paying the wage and then get it back.
No, I don't think so. I at the end of the day, I think that there's a certain level of understanding that if a program is going to be made, and programs that have been implemented have been by and large at the federal level when it comes to these kinds of things, and then the provincial government, not only in Ontario but across Canada, other provincial governments have either supplemented it, have been able to help administer it, but by and large this is a global pandemic. This is not just isolated to Ontario and to one specific region. So as a result of that, there needed to be, and there had been, quite frankly, and I've given the Prime Minister credit on this, a lot of work at the federal level to ensure that certain things that were needed across the country were there by level of support or by level of foundation in which and then the provinces were able to build on. And we saw a lot of that, in some cases differing issues and whatnot. And I think Premier Ford has always been pretty clear and has been pretty successful in the first year of this pandemic to ensure that everything that that the federal government was trying to do was implemented in Ontario. The things that were specific to Ontario were being altered and changed in order for people in Ontario to be looked after in some cases. But it is a constantly evolving and changing issue, as we know. And I think the federal government needs to sort of keep an eye on making sure that there's certain national standards out there that help all the provinces, including Ontario.
Let's turn now to the military is coming in. And it was, Karen, it was 2 weeks ago when the premier got, I thought, a bit huffy when the prime minister made the first offer saying, we don't need your help. We need vaccines. And suddenly he needs their help.
Yeah. It's been a bad couple of weeks for the provincial government, I think. And, if someone's offering help, the best advice is to take it. And we needed it. We knew we needed it because even having extra beds only is effective if you have the nursing staff and the medical staff to help the patients in those beds. And so it's just been a lot of miscommunication and a lot of poor messaging. And I think, there is a bit of the blame game back and forth. Don't blame me. It's your fault. When really it's not helpful. And, back to if we knew we were going to need the help, likely based on all the modeling that was the ICUs were going to get filled up, and that, more bodies are more helpful, because we've also heard that vaccine centers have to close because the nursing staff has been called away. And so all of that put together means that if someone's offering you help, you take it.
Yeah. Well, I guess at this point we are taking it. We also saw the premier saying he's going it alone to try and get more vaccines. Now, even the AstraZeneca is going to be curtailed because of the situation in India. It just seems like things are kind of almost out of control, Charles.
Yeah, listen, he's in a tough bind, and he's had a rough couple of weeks. But I give him credit for changing. He has a change of heart. One thing he does do, he does change his mind when he makes a decision, when he recognizes that there were bad decisions. The problem is, why did you get yourself into those predicaments in the first place, which is what's coming into question. But regardless of that, now he's open to the military and to Red Cross. He appreciates the need. I know I have a friend, I think he's actually listening to your show right now, who his son has been put on notice, and he's in the military. They're going to provide the medical staff, the nurses. These guys will bring the what's necessary to move beds and move tents and rearrange things as necessary. They'll do what they did with the old age homes as well. And it's good that we have support. It's good that we have other provinces willing to come forward, and it's great that the premier is open to it, because these priorities and his change of priorities from, to some extent, from this political stance to the realization that needs to happen in respect to managing this pandemic here at home. It's all about health and safety, and kudos to the Premier to show some courage in that regard.
Your pooch agrees. John, Jagmeet Singh has supported the budget, so for now, for this second, there's not an election. How do you see that whole little sideshow playing out?
Yeah, no. Let me also just address something Charles said, and sort of agree with him on the fact that I think it's important that you know when decisions are made and other facts come into play that a leader shows leadership by changing it or by altering it or by coming back with some decisions. I think we've seen that, and I admitted on the show last week that the Premier had a pretty bad week or two, and I think the fact is that a lot of it is because of the shifting sands that we're seeing on a regular basis, but at least he's trying to change it with respect to bringing in the army, bringing in sick pace, and all those areas that I think he's focusing on. So I think that from that perspective, I think that's positive. On the federal side, I am not surprised, and I think we might have even mentioned it on this program before where we talked about it pre-budget, that ultimately what will happen is the NDP will end up supporting it, even though Jagmeet Singh at some points decides that he wants to make a public statement to say, you know, even before the budget, that he would support it no matter what was in it, that he wouldn't cause an election. And then when the budget was announced and released, and then he would say, well, I'm sort of not made up my mind yet. I still might vote against it just to add a little bit of excitement, a little bit of suspense. But knowing full well, those of us that watch this closely, that there was no way that he was going to vote against it. So I'm not surprised. I do think that the Liberals do understand and appreciate that whatever they come back with, whatever they claim to be a confidence vote, that they can rely on the NDP to support them. And therefore, this I think this government will be in power, and at least until the fall, I suspect.
The fall. Karen, do you agree with that?
Hello?
Do you agree? The fall? The fall? Not till the fall for an election?
Oh, I don't think it's going to be until the fall. I agree with John on that one, because the vaccine, you know, they've said that it's going to take until September, really, until we're all vaccinated and kids are back to school and people can really think about going back to work and back in the office, rather. And so, you know, I think it would be premature to call it before the fall.
Mm-hmm. Charles, do you agree?
Yeah, I do, actually. I mean, the budget just came out. They're going to go through deliberations. The NDP will support it. Everybody, I don't think anybody has an appetite for an election just yet, although Elections Canada is certainly gearing up, and they're having all their offices and trying to get people ready if it were to happen. But we have a bigger issue here, and that's to fight this pandemic, not to fight the political arena. So, yeah. I think John's right. Nothing's going to happen until the fall. Until such time, we'll start getting some herd immunity or some sense that we're getting through this.
Mm-hmm. And John, what do you see as the big issues coming up? I mean, in terms, I'm very concerned now that the province has said that they want to clear space in hospitals by loading up the long-term care homes. But it seems to me that is just off the public radar.
Yeah, there's a number of things I think that are sort of happening now with respect to this third wave that seems to be increasing and quite frankly also affecting other provinces. We're at Nova Scotia, which has been unbelievably under control for the last little while, now sees a surge and so forth in other provinces as well. But I would say that even the Sunnybrook hospital grounds where they've got, you know, those tents that were set up, are now starting to see some patients, by way of trying to relieve some of the hospitals. And I think that anything is in play now to try to get, you know, relief where they can. Obviously, the hospital association has been saying for a number of weeks that the hospitals are going to get overcrowded and some of the surgeries needed to be done there. So other people that were in hospital that didn't need immediate surgeries could be passed on to other areas. And I think we're starting to see some of that happening, which is good. Also, I think that the army coming in and helping in some of that, you know, will probably relieve some of this some of the stress that's been happening over the last little while.
Karen, are we just forgetting about our elders?
Well, I was going to say it kind of seems like that's another ticking time bomb waiting to happen, because although we vaccinated We've had high rates of vaccination in the long-term care home and in assisted living and in retirement homes. Transferring patients from hospital into those facilities, those patients aren't necessarily vaccinated, and they certainly haven't received two vaccines.
Yeah, and the other thing, Karen, I want to let you finish, but they've decided that vaccinated workers can work in multiple homes, and there's no proof that being vaccinated prevents you from transmitting the virus.
That's correct, 100%. And also, we don't know that all the, I mean, we do know anecdotally that not every healthcare worker, frontline worker, or worker in assisted living or long-term care has also received a vaccine.
Right.
Because they may not have wanted to. And so we have a situation where we have the long-term care homes are actually relatively under control because all of those patients have been vaccinated. And now we're introducing a whole new level of uncertainty. And I don't think I think it's going to end in a disaster again.
Well, this is what got them into trouble in the first wave. And granted, okay, it's not going to be quite so bad because of vaccines. And frankly, because a lot of them have already died.
Right, right. And there's a huge issue. And so I guess it's out of necessity that they're making these moves, but one must really hope that they're really thinking through the implications of recreating the situation that happened in wave one.
Okay, and here is the thing, my bad, because I haven't got around to checking this yet. So if anybody knows the answer to this, my take on the way it reads, though, is that it's voluntary, that moving a patient from alternate level of care in a hospital into long-term care is voluntary. Do any of you know if that is correct?
My understanding, Libby, that it was voluntary, and it was also dependent upon the long-term care facility and whether or not there was room there for the acceptance. To Karen's point, you know, a lot of the patients and a lot of the care workers in long-term care facilities have been vaccinated, in some cases even twice now, have gotten their second doses. But I think it's based on voluntary, and it's based on capacity, and it's based on whether or not the long-term care facility can actually hold it in a safe way. Because what you don't want is to happen what happened in New York with the Governor Cuomo, where at the beginning he was sending sick patients to long-term care facilities and causing a huge disaster there.
Charles, I know you're involved with long-term care. What's your view of this?
Yeah, those ALC beds have long been an issue long before this. And because many didn't want to go to certain long-term care homes because they didn't feel as safe as they are in the ALC or the families. But with the new rules and conditions now being placed on long-term care, some of those patients may be better off in a secure home as opposed to being exposed in a hospital where they are just as much at risk as they would be anywhere else. But I know at least in Peel, there's a big push for increased long-term care facilities being partnering with the hospitals and with Trillium in this case, and that's to relieve some of the ALCs, these alternative levels of care that are overbearing in the hospital at this point.
Well, yeah, you're right that was a big problem. Even before this.
Absolutely. That's my point.
But there was nowhere safe to put these people. They put a lot of people into long-term care at the beginning of the first wave, and look what happened.
Mm-hmm. And partly because, as you mentioned, we had a number of mobile PSWs and others bringing the virus into the home from other locations and putting at risk some of our seniors. But equally at risk right now is this third wave, and the majority of whom are young people. And that, too, is another dilemma for us.
That is a challenge for sure. And that is, you know, the one demographic that was being hit hard by the first wave of the COVID-19, and this variant is now sort of hitting everybody else. So I'm glad to see that governments are starting to lower the age for vaccines, and more people are getting it. So that's a positive step. I got my vaccine last Friday, so I was excited by that.
Well, and you're a young dude.
I was in the 18 to 25 category.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's tragic when a young person loses their lives, but people just care so much more that it you know, to a certain extent, it makes me shake my head.
Yeah.
Anyway, we are out of time. Let's go around the virtual table. Karen, what would you like to leave us with?
Well, I do think that the vaccine take-up relative to our supply has been very good to date. And, you know, we're the medical officer of health indicated that in order for us to stay on track, we needed to vaccinate over 100,000 Canadians every day, or in Ontario, rather, pardon me, in Ontario, and we're meeting that target and exceeding it on many days, which is hopeful.
John?
Well, just on the vaccine subject, you know, and as I mentioned, I got my vaccine at a City of Toronto facility in my postal code because I was of the age and in the hotspot. And I'll tell you, the facility was an old Target store at a mall, and it was run like an unbelievable machine where you walked in, you were tested, you were checked with your health card, make sure you had an appointment, you were vaccinated, you had a 15-minute wait. I was out in and out within 20 minutes. It was just phenomenal. And so I'm glad to see that, and I'm also glad to see that more and more people are getting vaccinated, which is a good sign.
Charles?
Yeah, I'm encouraged by the number of people getting vaccinated. I got mine a few weeks back. But I am still, and I'm speaking for the Peel region where I'm in, there's still some degree of confusion. There's still some misunderstanding about the hot spots. It seems that some are being underserved, and yet they have critical need for those vaccines. And I just encourage all those of government. I know we have angry councillors and angry mayors disputing why Peel is not getting what they need, but it's not just Peel, of course, it's all across the province. Get those needles in those arms, regardless of age. Let's just get it done.
Okay. Thank you so much to our crack strategy panel, Charles Souza, John Capobianco, and Karen Stintz. Thanks a lot.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Thanks, Libby. Thanks, everyone.
Okay. We will talk soon. Right now, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll have the latest on the pandemic and what you should be doing with Dr. Alon Weissman when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.